under you. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Still we don't want no war, only love and unity. That's what the people see. They don't want no war, no hell. Because if this war should start, this world would be apart. You wouldn't see no people, much less a shadow. There would be no more people at all. Yes, Bush and Saddam, they say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, they say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Mass destruction. We can't ruin Mama Nature's plan. The earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I and I need unity. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I say we need unity. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, they say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. I wonder if it's the oil, and the oil can't spoil. You rather taking people's life, fighting over the oil. Yeah, to the world them won't put an end. Just a world without end. Right you know me friend, you have big grand from the drive. Of Jah world pass away, heaven and earth pass away. Yes, peace and love we a deal with. Peace and love we a deal with. Peace and love what we want. Yes, in a Jah side. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam. We don't want no war. We need the unity. We don't want no war. Strictly love and unity. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download this program from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Angry White Men. Sociologist Michael Kimmel has spent hundreds of hours in the company of America's Angry White Men, from white supremacists to men's rights activists to young students.
So it is really, I think interesting that sexism is far more casual, mm-hmm. Partly because it's the interpersonal, you know, these guys that I was talking with actually have relationships
a wife they
with
hate
women.
Or, yes,
they have ex-wives that they hate. They have ex-wives' lawyers who they hate even more. Mm-hmm. But they also have, you know, the women in their lives who they see as getting ahead of them.
Yeah, there's like a lot more women you can see as taking your job or, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we are going to return to that subject when we talk about specific groups, but I think it's important now to define this central concept of your book, which is this idea of aggrieved entitlement, right. Because I have a lot of questions about it, and so just tell the viewers, what is that? What is aggrieved entitlement? What does that
mean? Well, it's a phrase that I came up with because all of the different groups that I talk about, from the men's rights groups to the father rights groups to the guys who beat up their wives or partners or kill them in some cases, to guys who go postal or, you know, sort of open fire in the workplace, to the men on the extreme right. What I think the thread that binds all of them is this notion of aggrieved entitlement. And the easiest way I could describe it to you, Hannah, is to tell you one story where I first sort of encountered it. I was on a TV talk show opposite four of these men who were angry white men. And they all believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace. So it was a workplace show in which they were talking about how affirmative action was actually reverse discrimination against white men. They were qualified for jobs. They were qualified for promotions. They didn't get them, and boy, were they angry about it. So I was there opposite them, alongside Jill Nelson, the journalist who had written Volunteer Slavery. So the two of us were there sort of opposite them to sort of respond to them. And the reason I'm telling you this story is my first inkling of it was a quote from one of these men, which became the title of the show. The title of the show was "A Black Woman Stole My Job."
Yeah, I saw that in your book, right?
And I thought, you know, I said, okay, I have one question for you guys. And it's about the title of the show, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." Actually, it's about one word in the title. I want to know about the word "my."
Right.
Where did you get the idea it was your job?
Right.
Why isn't the title of the show "A Black Woman Got the Job" or
right.
"A Black Woman Got a Job"?
Right.
Because without confronting men's sense of entitlement, we won't understand why so many men, I think, resist gender equality. Because we think this is a level playing field. So, you know, you have a policy that tilts it even a little bit and you think, oh my God, water's rushing uphill. It's reverse discrimination against us. So this is what aggrieved entitlement, I think, it sounds like. These were our jobs. These were our positions. These are the ones that we were told when we were little, this is what is waiting for you. This is the scene, you know, the funniest scene of this entitlement that I've ever seen is in Monty Python, where he goes to the castle walls and in the Holy Grail and says, you know, and goes to the Lord goes to the castle wall with his son and says, "Son, one day this will all be yours." And the son says, "What, the curtains?"
Right.
You know, it's like it's like one day this will all be yours.
Right.
That is what fathers have said to sons.
Right.
And they expected this. They were entitled to it. And now you're telling them they're not going to get it. Now you're telling them after all these years you have to play fair.
Right. Right.
And so my feeling was that this was. I felt like when I heard this, it registered for me. And I began, as I was doing the research for the book, I began to hear it in a lot of different venues. And so I tried to use that as a framing device on what, because my argument in the book, or in a way, the way that our books kind of run parallel to each other, is I think this isn't the end of men, but this is the end of an era of assumed entitlement.
The end of male privilege, or the end of male entitlement. Right.
That's what I kept hearing from these guys. And they were kind of blindsided by it. You know, it's in our lifetime that the rules have completely changed from the office space in Mad Men. You know, where the men have all the corner offices and the women are like in a corral in the center, and you have your pick. You know, it's like an office perk to sexual harassment, women having the corner offices. I mean, it's been the pace of this change, and I think you point this out also.
It's been really fast and alarming.
It's dizzying. It's left guys just sitting there going, what happened?
So one thing I did while reading your book is trying to imagine one of these guys reading your book. And aggrieved entitlement makes absolute sense, but I did find it hard to accept them as entitled anymore. So like, you know, you have a phrase that sticks in my head, which makes total sense when you read it, especially to me and you. It's men have had the wind at their back for all of this time, right? So it's just, you've had tens of thousands of years. It was never a level playing field. We had the advantage and now we don't have the advantage anymore. It wasn't yours to begin with. It's like we had this push, but they don't feel that way, right? Like they don't wind at their back. Like they're looking at Obama Obama and Hillary Clinton. And, you know, they're looking at what the field looks like and it doesn't look like them.
That's right.
They can't get a job. As one of them says, the only job in my town is to be a Walmart hostess. And, you know, I'm not doing that job.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that it's a girl's job and it's not even that good a job. So I was having a hard time conceiving of why they should accept your argument that they were entitled.
Okay, so I have there's two levels of answer. It's a great question. There's two levels of answer to your question. The first is, does this actually describe their experience? And the second is, why should they then, like, agree with me?
Okay.
So the first part, it seems to me, is the mistake, I think, that we made, that we being sort of liberals, feminists, basically in the 1970s. Feminism sort of first began to, you know, sort of really permeate the culture in the 1970s. The argument looked something like this. Men have all the power. Mm-hmm. Just look at every single corporate board, every single legislature, state, local, national, international, you know, every university board. You know, men have all the power.
Mm-hmm.
And individually, so women don't have the power and women don't feel powerful individually. So feminism said to women, we as a group need to redress this imbalance of power at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And individually, feminism was about empowering women to have a wider range of choices, more options around reproduction, around family life, around balancing work and family, all those sorts of things. So it basically said, so there was a symmetry between the aggregate powerlessness and the individual experience of powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
You apply that to men.
Mm-hmm.
Men have all the power in the world. You just look at all these boards and stuff. Therefore, men must feel powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the men would go, what are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? My wife bosses me around. My kids boss me around. My boss bosses me around. I'm completely powerless. That analysis failed to resonate for men even then because men don't feel powerful.
Mm-hmm. Right? Never did or just don't now?
Well, because we, you know, because there's only one king of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us feel like we have to be subservient to idiotic bosses.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be, we have to, you know, I mean, you know, when you try telling my male students that they have all the power, they have to listen to me.
Right.
You know, I'm giving them a grade.
It's like an idea that was also prevalent in the Mad Men era,
exactly.
That men we are all little cogs in the wheel, and
that's right. And we're lemmings, and we all take the 737, and
Revolutionary Road.
I just put the widgets
here and there. Yeah, exactly.
So, and as a result, that syllogism, that kind of model, didn't really apply to men.
Now we're saying goodbye to Mitt Romney.
That's another role they're taking from me. We liked how he'd fight and would fake to the right.
And we loved how his smile was a little too tight.
Oh, what a beautiful Mormon.
He gave us jokes everywhere.
Pack a whole suitcase
just to transport Romney's hair.
Before that, we lost Dennis Kucinich,
whose name rhymed with nothing but spinach.
Then Brownback and Dodd left the race, and you know Kucinich picked them up on his UFO.
Oh, what a great bunch of morons. They gave us jokes all last fall. Voters are glad they are gone, but comedians will miss them all.
And now, back to Angry White Men with sociologist Michael Kimmel.
So then you had all these groups that sprung up in the 70s or so that basically said, you know how you don't feel powerful? You're right. They have all the power. Come on, guys, let's get it back.
Got it.
Right. Or you have another group that said, you know how you don't feel powerful? You're right. Let's go to the woods and we'll chant. Here's the power stick and the power drumming and the power chanting. And then you had all these Wall Street yuppies wearing power ties, eating power breakfast, as if power was some kind of fashion accessory.
Mm-hmm.
This was because the idea was men were supposed to feel powerful, but didn't. That's entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to feel this way. They don't feel this way. Whose fault is
that? And
right?
We'll move to whose fault is
And then when you move to whose fault is that, that's why they should agree with me.
Right.
Because I think that they have been sold a bill of goods. I think they have been duped. I think they have been hoodwinked. They've been betrayed. They've been stiffed. All of those sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
But not by the people they think.
Right. Got it.
Not by those lower than them. But
not
those,
by the the figment black woman, right?
No, not by the black woman who stole their job, but by the arrogant, cynical elites who are manipulating them into going after those below them, when in fact they can make common cause. So my argument to them is it's not Timothy McVeigh, it's Tom Joad, who is your model.
Right.
The one who makes common cause, who recognizes his plight.
Explain who that is so people won't.
Okay. Yeah, just Timothy McVeigh, of course, everybody knows, was the Oklahoma City bomber. Tom Joad is the hero of the Grapes of Wrath, the John Steinbeck novel about the Great Depression. A guy who is displaced, a migrant, an Okie on his way moving to California, buffeted by cynical elites, impossible bureaucratic odds, farmers who rip them off. And he finally realized that it's not the other guys who are trying to make a buck that are the problem. It is the people who are above him.
Right.
And he then goes off and he says to his mother in the great scene, can't you just see Henry Fonda sitting there by the candlelight saying this to his mother? Wherever there's a man, looking for a job, that's where I'll be. Mm-hmm. So he, Tom Joad, or as I say at the end, it's fascinating to me that both Timothy McVeigh and Nelson Mandela use the same poem, Invictus, as their motto. Mm-hmm. That guys like Tom Joad or Bruce Springsteen is another example, white working class guy who makes common cause with those below him rather than turns them into the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Thomas Frank, what's the matter with Kansas idea.
Precisely.
which you quote in the book, which is this argument, you're hating the wrong people is basically like instead of hating the corporate powers that have shipped your job overseas and completely forgotten about you and made no amends, you hate the people below you. You hate women, you hate black people, you hate the people you perceive
as stolen
your job.
It's a bait and switch, and that's what Thomas Frank says as well. And yes, I have great respect for that argument as well, because I think that that there's a kind of distraction going on very often with these, and it's a very seductive distraction.
Mm-hmm. So one of your most original chapters is about the Rampage Shooter and what we get wrong about the Rampage Shooter, and you sort of reconceive who the Rampage Shooter is. So can you talk about that a little bit?
By the Rampage Shooter?
School shooters.
I actually have a chapter also on guys who go postal.
Yeah, no, not them. That's different. Okay. I mean the school shooters, the young school shooters, Columbine shooters, those guys.
Well, I'm flattered that you think I have a new take on it, and I'm curious to know what you think. What you think is that is. I'll tell you what I think is new about it, the sociology of it. Mm-hmm. All of the work on the school shooters, all of the research that has been done, except for one superb anthropologist, Catherine Newman, who wrote a book called Rampage, virtually all of the ways that we have approached them has been a focus on the psychology of the shooters. Mm-hmm. So you have the extreme psychologization, for example, in some of the work on Columbine, David Cullen's book, for example, which basically is like looking at a Seurat painting, like really, really up close, so you see these dots, but you don't see a picture at all. It's guns, it's violent video games, Marilyn Manson, it's goth music, it's any of the one number of these causes that lead these guys to explode. Mm-hmm. And then there are those who have the more social psychological. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that they were completely bullied, that they were constantly beat up. All these guys have those stories, by the way.
So why does aggrieved entitlement in that situation?
So the additional part, and I'll get to the aggrieved entitlement part. So the additional piece that I add is that it's not enough to profile the shooters. Mm-hmm. We also have to profile the schools if they're school shooters. Mm-hmm. Now, Sandy Hook, by the way, is a complete exception to this.
Well, that wasn't a kid who...
That's right.
It wasn't
a student who was coming into his school.
Yeah.
So, and since Columbine, remember, and here's the aggrieved entitlement part, since Columbine, school shootings have taken a dramatic turn. You don't just go to school and try to kill as many of them as people did before Columbine. Remember Barry Lucatus or Michael Carneal, they're still in jail. Mm-hmm. But you also kill yourself at the end. This is not suicide. This is like suicide by cop. This is suicide by mass murder. Mm-hmm. You take out as many of them as you can because they have done you wrong. Mm-hmm. That's the constant line that goes through it. There's the aggrieved entitlement. The constant line that goes through all these school shooters. Their accounts are, you have done us wrong.
Uh-huh,
you have bullied us, beaten us up, ignored us, gay baited us, etc. Spread rumors about us, lied about us. And what's really interesting, I was thinking about this on the train down here, Hannah, mm-hmm. that that the Rampage school shooters are analogous to the boys' version of these girls who commit suicide after being so relentlessly cyberbullied and mm-hmm. beaten and, mm-hmm. And shunned and all of that, that they can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. The boys explode, the girls internalize. Mm-hmm. So this is, but it's a similar kind of dynamic. So it's not true that only boys bully, that mm-hmm. we know that's right. not true, but they have different kinds of responses to it. Mm-hmm. And for these boys, they feel wronged. They mm-hmm. feel badly done by. They mm-hmm. feel ignored. And I'll show you. I'll get even with you. That's their logic. Mm-hmm. Now, there are thousands of boys who are feeling this all the time.
Right.
So why is it that school shootings are, although horrifying and in some ways, seemingly a regular occurrence, also reasonably rare? Like mm-hmm. 99% of schools haven't had one. Why? If there are thousands of boys who are feeling this every single day in their basements, in their attics, in their bedrooms, blowing up the galaxy mm-hmm. on their computer, wanting to take revenge. Why don't they? Well, because, and there you have to profile the schools. You mm-hmm. have to say something about the schools in which these school shootings take place. They have certain characteristics. Mm-hmm. They are what one sociologist called the jockocracy, mm-hmm. the place mm-hmm. where the jocks rule it. At Columbine, for example, one of the players parked his Hummer in a 15-minute zone all day, never got mm-hmm. a ticket because the administration basically sort of protected him. Mm-hmm. These guys rule the school, and the administration and the faculty collude with them. You take the case, for example, of Steubenville, Ohio, not mm-hmm. that long ago. Mm-hmm. These guys, these athletes, if you remember what happened, this is what entitlement sounds like. Mm-hmm. These guys gang raped this girl mm-hmm. and filmed it. Mm-hmm. And one of them got worried and said to the other one, we can get in trouble for this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other one said, don't worry about it. The coach will take care of us. He'll, mm-hmm. he'll clean it up. And mm-hmm. sure enough, what did the coach do? That day, he immediately did exactly what this guy said. He mm-hmm. he questioned why the girl was there, what she was mm-hmm. wearing, what she was drinking, whether she had led them on, whether she
right,
was
we've
complicit.
Had several cases like
right.
this in the
so,
right.
What? How did the city of Steubenville, Ohio deal with this absolutely a horrific response by a coach? They rehired him, mm-hmm. right? So we're not talking about the Steubenville 2 now. Now we're talking about the entire town rallies behind the coach who mm-hmm. who runs interference with the players. Mm-hmm. That's what entitlement sounds like. This football player was right.
Right.
He was entitled mm-hmm. and everything worked out as he expected it would. Mm-hmm. So my feeling is that's what we have. I want to interrupt.
Right. Yeah, no, I understood that. It seemed to me a slightly different point than the point in the rest of the book, because those jocks can also enter the aggrieved entitlement. Like, that's a more real phenomenon than in other places where, one day those jocks could be Rick at the gun show. Do you know what I mean? When they grow up. At the moment, they're not. But that's like old-fashioned class.
Can I just say something? Let me say something about that, though. That is really interesting, Hannah, because these guys, the athletes, the mm-hmm. top jocks, the homecoming kings and all, uh-huh. they also feel that they have aggrieved entitlement.
Yeah, yeah,
they're walking
yeah.
around, they'll say, the guys would tell me, athletes, with high status guys on campus, we're walking around with targets on our back. Everyone's
right.
looking to get us, to do us in. We're the poor victims here.
Right. Like, I felt
everybody
bad
everybody wants
like,
to be a victim.
Everyone wants to be a victim. Like, that. The relationship between the shooters and the jocks that you describe, that could have taken place in many decades. Mm. It's like the entitlement of the jocks, the Hummer. It's more just sort of what happens to those jocks that's the new thing, where every guy feels like he just can't make it.
Yeah.
And then my only other response to that chapter is, it didn't seem to me like you had to choose between psychology and sociology. Like, they're both, whatever. You have sociology, and then you have some people who interact with that sociology in a
right.
way which makes them crazy. So, but it's not, it's not necessarily
I don't
choice.
Think you sacrifice one for the other. I think
yeah.
that they work in, that sociology provides that context and psychology provides the insight into the individual behavior. Why this person and not this person in that context?
Right. Now, the section of your book, which I greatly appreciated because I've been so curious and edited many stories about it, is the sort of thorough take on the men's rights movement, because I think there's a lot of confusion about what is this men's right. You have a sense that they're very angry, but you have a sense that they have legitimate grievances, and you have a sense that there's sort of an old history to it. But it was very useful, I think, to put all those strands together and kind of separate them in the way
right.
you did. So maybe I'll start actually with the history of the men's rights movement, which was quite new to me. I had forgotten it. So can you just talk about the origins of the movement and where it comes from?
Well, I locate the origins of the men's rights movement in Guy's response in the 1970s to the beginning of the women's liberation movement, the mm-hmm. The feminist movement. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of men who were, because what feminism, you know, basically challenged was what was called by social psychologists the female sex role, that you have to be nice, pretty, quiet, you know, and do all of those. And women were saying, that's not who we are. We are ambitious. We're assertive. We're competent. We want to do stuff.
Right.
And we don't want to sacrifice any of that nice, nurturing, loving stuff either. We want to be moms and workers and all that stuff. We want to lean in. We want to listen up. We want to do all of it.
Right.
Okay. So men basically were saying, you know, and the women in our lives were all, you know, like getting, you know, becoming feminists and critiquing our behavior. Mm. And so a lot of guys said, you know, well, they're right. Women have gotten a raw deal here. They can't be all that they, and golly, so have we. Mm-hmm. We have gotten a raw deal. The male sex role sucks. Mm-hmm. You can never express your feelings. You can never tell people that you love them. All of your relationships with men are completely, you know, restricted by homophobia and the terror that other people might get the wrong idea about you, whatever. So being a man sucks too. Mm-hmm. And then there was those who said, it sucks just as much. Mm-hmm. And then some guys were even saying, it sucks more.
Right.
But
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's second inaugural address in 1937.
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day. I see millions whose daily lives in city and on farm continue under conditions labeled indecent by a so-called polite society half a century ago. I see millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better the lot of themselves and their children. I see millions lacking the means to buy the products of farm and factory, and by their poverty, denying work and productiveness to many other millions. I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And now for something completely different.